got it. Hey, everyone, once again. Okay, now we're going to try this here. So let's see what we got there. And, okay, Matt, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay, all right. We got some voice here. So it's a little bit light on this side here. I'm going to try to move it up a little bit. Don't want to overwhelm it. So on the phone with me is Matt Burgles, who's making his way towards Idaho Springs. You know, you're probably about 2-3 miles east of the Veterans Memorial Tunnels. Used to be the Twin Tunnels. But you're moving along. We thought we're going to go ahead and get this started, this conversation. And you know, then when you get here, we can flip it out real fast. You come on in the studio, jump down, and we'll get a little better quality on the sound. How's that sound?
Sounds great, and you sound perfect over the phone.
All right. Yep. But in my headphones, I'm hearing a little bit of feedback there. But, you know, I'm getting you. It's soft, but it's clear, you know, when you're talking. So that's great. So, Matt, you know, I got this bio here about you. You know, and, you know, everything you've done, you know, in this time, but, you know, maybe what we'll do is, let you just talk about you a little bit here. And, we have, because we will eventually talk about Larry Habersfield and how Larry saves the prairie. That's your work. Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, as you recall, because I've been on your show many times, it's been several years now, mm-hmm. I am a retired teacher. And just kind of starting there, the last few years, I went on and went back to school, got my PhD in public affairs. And in my research agenda, I focused on how growth and development affects wildlife. And obviously, living here in Colorado, we have a lot of growth and development encroaching on wildlife habitat. We have for a long time, and it's continuing. And so as I went through that process, my plan was to retire from teaching and go out and get a job in the nonprofit sector doing wildlife conservation. I found out, unfortunately, rather quickly, that age of 50 and most of your adult life and your professional career in one profession does not make for a smooth transition into another. So as you also recall, I ran for the state legislature. That was not successful. But in the meantime, I have been doing some teaching. I am a mediator and a facilitator, and I do that for a nonprofit out of Denver. We do lots of citizen police mediations and neighborhood mediations and facilitations and so on. But also in my spare time, I do a lot of research concerning wildlife.
Okay, we'll break it up a little bit. Okay, broken up here. Yeah, you broke up there a little bit, so we missed that last 30 seconds or so.
Yeah, so I was saying I've been doing a lot of research on my own, unable to get an official job in a nonprofit working on wildlife habitat conservation. So I worked as a research associate for the Denver Zoo. Mm-hmm. And in my work there, I came across lots of private landowners who were doing the right thing for wildlife habitat. And that was my biggest interest. That's what I did my dissertation on for my PhD. And I felt that since over 60% of the land mass in the United States is owned by landowners, many of them large landowners, of course, ranchers and farmers, that that seemed to be an area that needed a lot of attention. So as I did my work with the Denver Zoo, I came across this great man named Larry Habersfield, who is a rancher out in western Kansas. And Larry, it seems, as you know, I assume most of your listeners probably know, of course, Kansas is a very rural and very conservative state. And they are, you know, for the most part, kind of the anti-government group of conservatives. They don't like government telling them what to do. They're land rights people. They don't like a lot of rules and regulation. And they're independent farmers, ranchers, and so on. So with that said, as a little bit of a background, there is a 100-year-old law on the books in Kansas. Actually, now it's about 110 years old, I guess. And it says that every county and their commissioners, as their governors, the government, can make landowners do things to their land against their own will. And that applies mostly to the eradication of rodents, which, of course, prairie dogs fall under.
Mm-hmm.
So they came out to Larry's land. This is Lincoln County, Kansas. They came out to his land, which is about 10,000 acres, and they decided that he had too many prairie dogs and that they had to go. Larry found out about this, and he said, you know, I don't really want you to do that because it's my land. I don't want people coming on my land without my permission and poisoning my, what he called, wildlife. He didn't call them rodents or vermin, you know, mm-hmm. varmints or anything like that. Obviously, this didn't go over well in most of the county, and so several meetings were held, and I'm leaving a lot of the story out here, of course. This took place over a period of maybe 6 or 7 years.
Okay.
And so meetings occurred and so on, and Larry went, and as they say in rural areas, he wasn't going to be elected prom king with his attitude toward
I can imagine.
In western Kansas, you know, 99.9% of the people think the only good prairie dog is a dead prairie dog. Larry explained that, you know, prairie dogs are, of course, a keystone species, which means all of the prairie ecosystem depends on them. He said, I don't think God put these critters here for us just to poison. He talked about how millions of them roamed the Great Plains along with buffalo and so on, and how he had a better way to ranch in harmony with nature, including prairie dogs, than spending time and money on poison and shooting and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so again, moving forward, the county did go ahead and start the poisoning process on several different occasions. Larry went to Audubon of Kansas, which is a conservation organization, of course, and he got, through them, an attorney named Randy Rothbun, who decided to come to Larry's assistance and help him navigate the legal aspects of this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And Randy would stay with him for the duration of it. It ended up in the Kansas Supreme Court, again, after years of litigation, moving through the court system. And ultimately, Larry won.
Mm-hmm.
And so the prairie dogs are now thriving on his land and doing very well. And
all right. So why don't you, let's just pause it right there, Matt, because Matt just walked into the studio, and we could get him with almost without missing a beat. So I'm going to hang up the phone, and here we go. So can you hear me now?
Perfect.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I mean, what an ordeal, huh?
Yeah, again, I apologize for being late. I left an hour before. Normally it takes me a half hour. Actually, I left over an hour before, but I should have known. Anyway, that's why I tried to call early and get us on the phone, but I'm glad that it's working out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, yeah, no, we got a great conversation going here, so appreciate it. And, yeah, it gets brutal coming down. You got all that volume coming into this very narrow corridor down here.
Ugly.
So anyway, yeah, we're talking about Larry and Larry Haversfield. And, we got a couple books here, and thank you. And there's an interesting background story I think I might have emailed you on, but I'll have to explain that in a little bit. But let's keep talking about what Larry encountered, what he did out there in western Kansas.
So as it wound through the court system, it got somewhat of a, I guess for the type of story it is, it got a big following in the media, ending up in the New York Times, the Washington Post, some major newspapers like that. And he got, albeit a small one, but he got sort of a, I guess you would say, folk following,
mm-hmm.
As, you know, the rebel with a cause, I guess you could say. And that's, again, how I kind of found out about this. And so I looked into it more, and I started to research Larry more, and ended up contacting him, asking him if I could come to his ranch, told him a little bit about my background, similar to what I told you. And he said, yeah, absolutely, come out. So I like to whenever I travel, I have two children who are now early teenagers. And so if I can do business travel and take them along and have some kind of pleasure along the way, or vice versa, that's what I do. So we decided we are going to go to St. Louis. I have a friend who works, he's a vice president of Rawlings, and he was going to take us into the luxury box at Busch Stadium, all of that kind of thing. It so happens that I-70 runs just north of the Haverfield property, about 20 miles. And so, you know, I told the kids, let's go. We're going to go to this ranch for a day, and then we'll go on to St. Louis and the baseball game. So I went there, and I had seen some pictures of Larry. And if your audience is familiar at all, some of the older folks probably will be, and hopefully some of the younger ones with their history classes, with Norman Rockwell. Larry is the epitome of a Norman Rockwell figure. He is the quintessential rancher in that he always wore blue bib overalls, a short sleeve shirt, usually just a white t-shirt, undershirt kind of thing, an old hat, lots of mud caked on it and most of his clothes, worn out boots. And, you know, he's just the perfect looking guy for this role. We met Larry. We got in his old blue Ford pickup truck and started the tour of the ranch. And we saw just, you know, beautiful landscapes and beautiful wildlife everywhere. We saw eagles, we saw hawks, we saw foxes, we saw coyotes, we saw pronghorn, and of course we saw thousands of prairie dogs. You can hear them everywhere. And it was so good not only to see the wildlife thriving, but to see someone who seems, on the one hand, so in tune with the rural Kansas culture, and on the other hand, such an outlaw in that he went against his county government, his state government, and most all of his neighbors and saying, I think I'm doing the right thing, and here's why. And he wasn't afraid to stand up in these public meetings and say so, and on radio and to, you know, the press and so on. And in the end, again, he eventually won. About a year later, unfortunately, when I called back to see, I think I was calling back to see if I could go visit the ranch again. I spoke with one of his adult children who said, well, he's not here anymore. He is in the hospital, and then he was eventually moved to a nursing home. He had been diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, my heart just sank. And sure enough, it wasn't long after. And unfortunately, I guess, or ironically maybe, which endears me to him even more, about the same time I was diagnosed with cancer. Fortunately, my prognosis turned out to be a lot better than his, because obviously I'm still around and kicking. Larry only lived a few months longer. And the day that I found out about his death, I decided right then that I wanted to do something to honor him and in his memory. And I had thought about doing this children's book because I thought, again, he was such a great character that kids would love. And I teach part-time now in an elementary school. And so I, you know, called the family immediately with my condolences and then said, hey, you know, this is what I'm thinking about. Would I have your blessing to continue down this path and see what we can do? And they said, absolutely, let us know what we can do to help. So they were very much in favor of the project. They contributed information along the way. They did a lot of editing. They looked at the illustrations and said, tweak this. This isn't good. What about that? So it's totally my story. However, they kind of guided me along the way. And I'd like to think that maybe Larry's spirit guided me a little bit too. So what you hold in your hand there is the finished product. And I think, you know, from my perspective, the story is great. It's told in kids' language, obviously, for about grades K through four. In the back, there's some more adult type things. If you go to the very back of the book, there's a couple pages called How You Can Help. And I talk about four different organizations who are devoted exclusively to helping the prairie heal, the remnant prairie, I should say. Obviously, it's been beaten up and battered and subdivided and crisscrossed and fenced, and the animals there have been shot and gassed and everything for a couple hundred years. But these organizations, the American Prairie Reserve, Audubon of Kansas, Great Plains Restoration Council, and the Southern Plains Land Trust, all are doing whatever they can to conserve the prairie habitat and the prairie wildlife. GPRC, the Great Plains Restoration Council, is a little different in that not only is it trying to conserve the prairie, but it is also developing youth leaders and teaching them about ecological health as well. So the American Prairie Reserve, their goal is to create what they call an American Serengeti, a few million acres of land up in Montana, in conjunction with the existing public lands that are protected up there. They want to add as much as they can through conservation easement and outright purchase of land. And the same kind of thing is happening on, as of now, a smaller scale right here in southern Colorado with the Southern Plains Land Trust. So my kids and I go out and help them. We remove fence and do other things to help the prairie. So also in the back here, and then I'll stop talking for a minute, is an acknowledgement section. And more importantly, I think the story behind the story, which tells a little bit more about the story I was telling you a few minutes ago concerning how I became interested in this, how I grew up loving the prairie, and you know, what I saw was a real injustice as to what was happening to it, and then how I came to know Larry and so on.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, it's an amazing story. You know, I mean, when I came across it, you contacted me, and I looked at the site, and wow. And I started reading about Larry, and then I'll come back to this other personal connection. But so a number of questions here. I want to come back to that. But before we do, I just want to just remind our listening audience that this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7 and 103.9. And I didn't mention before, our sponsor this hour is Dex. So if you have any needs, Dex.com, 1-800-CALL-DEX, and get that information needs here. Visiting with my old friend Matt Burgles, and former educator and still an educator, as I am. We're both retired, and his work here, Larry Saves the Prairie. And I want to talk more, and I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of reading out of this too, Matt, in a little bit. But I want to back up to the issue itself about the prairie, and why is it, besides just a yucky, immoral, ethical thing, not to be poisoning the prairie dogs and the other critters that are there, the wildlife, why is it important for them to stay, for the health of the prairie itself? Why, you know, that it's a good thing in that way environmentally?
Sure. Again, I think the key place to start, the answer to that, is to just talk about prairie dogs as keystone species. Literally everything on the prairie depends upon them. And I want to get to the black-footed ferret here, which is an endangered species, which really was the key in Larry's victory, because as we know, the Endangered Species Act tries to save animals on the brink of extinction. And the black-footed ferret is one animal who was not only on the brink of extinction, but was actually thought to be extinct until 1981, when a ranch dog up in near Matisse, Wyoming, came home with something in his mouth, plopped it on the front porch of his ranch house. The farmer or the rancher who owned the house, he just looked at it, figuring it was some kind of dead rodent, took it, put it in the trash. His wife went out shortly thereafter to dump the trash and saw this, and was thankfully astute enough to say, that doesn't look like anything I've ever seen. So she picked it up and she took it to the local U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office. And sure enough, it was a black-footed ferret, which again, most people, including the Fish and Wildlife Service, had long ago thought was extinct. They found the colony of these ferrets. There were only 18 left. So that means that to the best of our knowledge to this day, there were 18 of these creatures left on the planet. So the debate ensued, do we leave them as is? Do we post guards on around their colony, or do we capture them, some of them, and try to do a forced breeding program? The decision was made with a lot of reluctance to do the forced breeding program. It's had its ups and downs, but now there are probably over 1,000 black-footed ferrets. We have a black-footed ferret recovery breeding facility near Fort Collins, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has one person, along with several helpers, devoted totally to that program, and I've been able to meet with him, and he works still with the Haverfield family. So when that animal was found, and they put out a call for private landowners to accept the release of ferrets onto the property with suitable habitat, Larry rose his hand, so to speak, quickly. And the ferrets were put on the land. They took successfully. And so as the court case, or cases, I should say, proceeded, as I was explaining a few minutes ago, eventually the Kansas Supreme Court said Kansas law through the federalism does not overrule the Endangered Species Act. There are endangered species on the land. They depend entirely upon the prairie dogs for shelter and for food and for everything. Therefore, it will be a violation of the act to poison them. And so that eventually is how we won.
Okay. And is the ferret a natural predator of the prairie dog?
Absolutely, yes. That's their sole source of food, as far as I know. That's the only thing they eat. They don't dig their holes themselves. They use prairie dog holes. So the prairie dog provides that. Again, you know, the idea, and this is brought out in the book, and kids really like this part. I've been to several live readings of the book, and there's some really good illustrations, I think, of horses and cows walking over the holes. There's this old myth out there, along with several others, but one of them that ranchers like to say is, well, you know, my horses, they step in the holes and break their legs. My cows break their legs. This is a myth that's been perpetuated for years and years and years through generations. And when you ask these people, really, can you show me one of these horses? Do you have any pictures? Do you have any proof? Can you document any one of these? Nobody has ever been able to do that. If anyone has ridden a horse, and I'm sure many of the people listening certainly have, you know that horses are very sure-footed. I haven't ridden a lot, but I have done my time on the back of a horse, and you can see from sitting up there that their eyes are always moving. They always know where they're stepping. They look down. They're smarter and more sure-footed than human beings when it comes to walking over things. So that's just a myth. The other myth is they spread the bubonic plague. It is true that they carry sylvatic plague, which is the same as the bubonic plague. However, as the book points out, unless you were to actually grab a prairie dog who was infected with these fleas and pet it, your chances of getting the plague are almost zero. Then there's the myth that there's too many prairie dogs out there. You know, they breed like rabbits, is the old cliche, or they breed like rats or prairie dogs. Actually, there's less than 1% of the numbers of prairie dogs left that there were in their historic heyday a few hundred years ago. And the land that they occupy is less than 1% that they used to occupy as well. And then finally, of course, is that they're bad for the land. They eat all of the grass. They leave none for cattle, which again is a myth. All you have to do is look at the fact that, you know, we think 100 million, maybe 30 to 100 million bison roamed the West. Prairie dogs were part of the ecosystem. They aerated the land. The bison thrived. There was plenty of forage for them. The problem is that as white Europeans came and started to fence the land and pen in their animals with barbed wire fence, you know, cows are confined to small spaces. They eat the land, they eat the grass, and it's blamed on the prairie dog. And so Larry, this is a key to what he started to do. He started to mimic what the bison did by moving his cattle daily. And it was kind of cool to watch because I had seen this on video before I went there. And sure enough, there he was with his overalls and his hat and a Yamaha motorcycle herding these cows. You know, most people think of a cowboy on horseback. He used a motorcycle. He herded them from paddock to paddock, and he did that every day. And as a result, the land was much healthier. The grass was much healthier.
Sustainable.
Absolutely. He didn't use any, to my knowledge, he didn't use any artificial herbicides or fertilizers. And, you know, he said, I kill my prairie dogs the old-fashioned way because the prairie dogs are healthy. There's lots of raptors that come and keep them in check. Whereas where you go to these other ranches where poison is used to kill the prairie dogs, there's no eagles, there's no hawks, there's certainly no ferrets. And so, you know, again, Mother Nature seems to be a little bit smarter than human beings. And finally, and this is the key to convince people, I think. Finally, you know, Larry was able to make a profit, and his family, who now runs the property and the ranching operation, they make a lot more money now than they did because they have a lot of time and a lot more money to do what they need to do for their cows and for their business than going around poisoning and worrying about prairie dogs.
How is this playing out then socially and politically now? You talk, because this took place, what, about 15 years ago, right around the turn of the century, I think, if I did my background reading correct.
Correct, yes.
Okay. And so the battle's over, the courts have decided, and so on. Is there a shift in thinking among the people there, or are they still, you know, like digging at their heels on this?
I wish I could sit here and say, oh, yeah, everybody has changed their mind because of the Larry Haverfield story. Unfortunately, I think that a lot of people are aware of it, and I think that it may have opened up some eyes to the possibility. But as far as any kind of sea change in the thinking, in the culture, in the politics, very little, if any, has occurred.
Don't confuse me with facts sort of stuff here.
Exactly. You know, so one of the reasons why I wrote the book was not just, you know, for the entertainment of kids. My ulterior motive was to get it in the hands of kids and, you know, have parents read this to their kids and get it in the rural areas of Kansas. And we've made some progress with that. Audubon of Kansas, to their credit, purchased about 1,000 of these books and promised to get them in every library in Kansas and as many elementary school libraries as they could. With the limited marketing that I've been able to do, I think that the book was out there. It was up for an award for the Kansas Significant Book Awards, which are awarded every June. It's an award given to the 10 best, not significant, but essential, Kansas essential books. The 10 best books about Kansas are written by somebody from Kansas. It was up for that award. Unfortunately, it didn't make the final 10. But, you know, we've made a few dents out there, and I think that it started a bit of a conversation, but not enough to really make any lasting change.
Okay. And I'm sure you weren't able to hear my first guest here, Richard Riemann, but we were talking about audiobooks, so that might be something to consider, think about. I don't know if you already have, about getting this in on an audiobook that literally the children could be listening. Richard was talking about how, you know, this revolution that's going on, the spike in popularity of audiobooks, and it's, I shouldn't say spike because that means there's going to be a decline. No, it's a steady, you know, people were starting to move to it because, you know, they could listen to it on their cell phones, on their smartphones, and while you're driving across Kansas, you know, and then it's like, okay, so you have this lesson, the children could be listening to. So an idea in that way, I don't know if that's something you consider or thought about.
Absolutely. And it may be, my first reaction when you brought that up is that it is. However, I believe I was probably thinking about the Kindle edition. It is available on Kindle. It may be available now in audiobooks. I will have to check Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. But that's a very good point. That might be the next step in the marketing of this.
Okay, because you're obviously reaching to a double audience. One, the children, so we can start educating them on this and get away from this mythology that gets out there that has absolutely no basis in fact, you know, that they are a nuisance in the first place. And then by the process that they are eliminating them, they are now affecting the other species as well.
Right.
And instead of just letting nature, you know, it's the Darwinian thing, survival, you know.
Sort sure. Of. You know, unfortunately, when you were saying letting the facts get in the way and so on, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but that seems to be the nature of our country in present time. I mean, just look what's happening in the political realm now. You know, people ask me all the time, because of my background in politics, can Donald Trump actually win? And I say, absolutely. And they'll say, yeah, but. And I'll say, absolutely, because we don't live, unfortunately, in a country where it comes to political, social, and to a degree, economic issues, but that's a whole nother area, I think. We don't use a lot of background research and maybe even not common sense in making our decisions. We make decisions, I think, and I'm talking collectively as a society, we make our decisions based upon emotion, which unfortunately comes to, you know, comes from a lot of bad information and what we only want to hear. Thus, again, the myths that I point out in the book about the prairie dogs. You can sit there and talk till you're blue in the face about, this is a myth, here's the reality. You know, another analogy would be global warming. You know, people, because they're not on fire yet, they simply say, oh, that's just a big liberal hoax, or that's, you know, somebody just making it up for their own interests. You can take all of the 120 or so Nobel Prize winning scientists who say, here's the science behind it. People don't care. And I think that's what's going on here. So it's really tough to crack that nut.
Yeah, that is true. If you're talking to older people that look like you and me, okay. However, your target audience are children. And we're retired educators, and we're still educating. We're having a conversation now. This is about education. And that's the audience you listen to, because children are open-minded there. And they read this story. They hear this story. And then when dad or grandpa says this, they go, but no, that's not the case, dad or mom. And, you know, so we put that little kernel inside them, which frustrates people like that. But that's what education is about. It's about opening the mind.
Right, exactly. And you hit the nail on the head. That's the whole purpose of this. You know, I thought about doing some sort of scholarly work similar to a doctoral dissertation or, you know, some sort of book that ends up on the shelf somewhere. And I decided to go with the children's book for the very reason you just said, because children are open and wide-eyed. And in my experience in the elementary school, they're very aware of animals. They're very aware of wildlife. And, you know, most all of them love animals. They love wildlife. And when you tell them some of the bad things that are happening out there, they immediately want to do something about it. So the idea, yeah, was exactly that, to get into the minds of the kids, you know, not to brainwash them, but to simply present them with the facts and say, mom, dad, that's not right. You know, here's the reality of it, and here's the science behind it.
And it seems like, now I haven't read the story yet, and I'm going to ask you to do a reading here shortly, but that you personalized it, because it seems like these critters have names. So they become, you know, they're not cartoonish, you know, but they're real. They have thoughts and so on.
Right. Exactly. And so, yeah, that was the, you know, when I first thought about this, I said, how can I make this into a kid's story that appeal to kids? And I said, well, let's tell it through the eyes of the prairie dogs themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I narrowed it down to a male and a female prairie dog. My original names were Prudence and Pablo. The publisher apparently thought that there was a better way to go, and so we kicked it around a while. With the input of the Haverfield family, we decided to go with kind of the more Western ranch-sounding names, I guess, and it ended up being Annabelle and Angus.
Love it.
And
that's great.
Annabelle, as you can see, carries an umbrella throughout the story, and Angus has a little ball cap on that has the initials LH, of course, for Larry Haverfield. So, yeah, they tell the story, and I think kids really relate to this. The nice thing about this is I had a ready-made laboratory every day. I would bring drafts of this to school and drafts of the illustrations and read them to the kids and say, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And they provided lots of honest feedback. I had plenty of adults to give me feedback, but, you know, I said, this is, after all, an audience for kids. And they loved the story. They made some great suggestions, and that's how it ended up being what it is.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm just kind of flipping through the pages as you are describing that process there. And, I mean, it's amazing because the little critters are telling the story, and then you have the background on the other page there. And so what do you, when you do a presentation, pull it open. I want to hear you read. What's kind of your grabber?
Well, I think obviously, you know, the first page is sort of a grabber, and then after that we introduce Larry a little bit. And then the part where the white Europeans are rolling through over there on about page 7, I think, is a highlight of the story. And then we get to an airplane crashing. As a private pilot, I thought this was a good analogy of what it means by keystone species and ecosystems. And so Angus is saying keystone species are sort of like the wings of an airplane. If you remove an airplane's wing, it won't fly. And then Annabelle is saying, so we're kind of like wings. And there's an illustration of a pilot with sweat pouring off his head, his airplane about to crash with a wing flying off. And so I make some simple analogies like that in order to get the point across of the importance of prairie dogs and how they work in the ecosystem and so on. And then there's some other words about ecosystems. The myth part is always real cool. One page that the kids really like is the one about fleas that I mentioned earlier. I put a gigantic flea on there. It says, even though we are extremely important to the prairie, there are many reasons why some people don't like us. For instance, they think the fleas that sometimes live on us make people sick. But unless a person touches a prairie dog, it's almost impossible for them to get sick. And we have the gigantic flea about to jump on a guy's back, and he's running away. And the prairie dogs are saying, we do our best to keep our fleas to ourselves. And then Angus says, I sure wish people tried to understand us better. Yeah. And then on the next page, we have the prairie dogs talking about, you know, the myth of what they do to the grass. It says, we keep it short and then it grows back. This makes it more nutritious for bison, pronghorn, antelope, and deer, as well as cattle. Mm-hmm. Just like getting a haircut, grass needs a trim every once in a while, and then it grows back even stronger than before. And then the other myth I mentioned a few minutes ago, some folks think there are too many of us, even though there are millions less now than when people first began to move west. And then you see again the horses and the cattle. This is the page that I spoke about. We have the horses and the cattle gingerly stepping over the holes, wide-eyed, looking down. And Angus says horses and cattle sense our underground homes and avoid them, and they're sure-footed. Being sure-footed means that horses and cows rarely stumble or fall. And then we get into the kill notice, as you see on the next page, of Larry getting the notice, and then he takes it to Randy, the attorney. So I actually said something good about attorneys here. As you can see, as Larry is handing the notice to Randy, the attorney, and by the way, a lot of kids see the attorney there, and they think that's me because of the hairstyle. And Annabelle and Angus say, a lawyer, someone who knows the law really well, and they help people with big problems. So all you attorneys out there, this is an attorney-friendly book. Then you see Larry in his trademark orange sweatshirt or hoodie releasing the ferret. This picture is all over. If you do a search on Larry Haverfield, you'll see it, I think, in the New York Times, a lot of the Defenders of Wildlife videos and pages and so on. And they start to talk about extinction, which means there are no animals left of a species. And then you see Larry on the next page going to the town meeting, and a lot of his neighbors, the farmers and the ranchers there. And Larry is talking to them about the benefits of prairie dogs for the ecosystem. And he told me personally, you know, I actually said I like prairie dogs, which he said it was just a stunned silence and people's mouths just fell, you know, with the look. How can you actually say that? How can you actually think a prairie dog is a good thing? Well, I like my favorite line in the whole book. There's the last sentence on that page. At the end of the meeting, Larry wondered who was smarter, people or prairie dogs. And I certainly wonder that a lot, too. And they talk about the law, and you see Angus and Annabelle saying, how did that law ever last so long? It's hard to believe, isn't it? And, you know, you want to say, well, this is conservative Kansas, after all. And, you know, in my opinion, a part of the conservative philosophy is looking in the rearview mirror, longing for the good old days. And then the good old days to them are back when, you know, we could kill and shoot and poison anything we wanted at any time we wanted. And hopefully those times are beginning to change.
Well, so then, just a side point on that, and we say conservative, and a root word of that is conserve.
Right.
Okay.
So very good point. I bring that out in my adult audiences all the time. I think our conservative friends have forgotten the root word, yeah, conserve, which means conserve natural resources, including wildlife. Yeah, I've written and talked about that very topic. Thank you for bringing that up. It wasn't in my mindset just now. And so then you see Larry talking a little more. I think this may have been one of the only times in his life where he actually wore a shirt and tie. And he's talking a little bit more. Then you see the famous picture, not picture, but illustration based on the pictures of him riding the motorcycle. And I got to put a plug in here for Rob Peters, the illustrator here, who I've ironically never met. We did everything over the phone and by email and text, but he's a Kansas guy. The family recommended him. They wanted someone in Kansas. He's done a lot of children's work concerning the Kansas City Chief and the University of Kansas and so on. And he ended up nailing Larry's character perfectly. And there you see him herding the cows. Some more about the grass and then how Larry took down fences and put up grass fences, but his neighbors still didn't get it. And then it goes a little bit in very simple kid terms into the court system. And finally, it says the endangered well, Larry and Betty, that's his wife, had to go before a judge, and the lawyer came to help. They explained to the judge that because of a law called the Endangered Species Act, the black-footed ferrets had to be protected, and the judge agreed. And you see the proceedings happening. So the kids hopefully learn a little bit about court. And the Endangered Species Act was created to protect species that are at high risk of becoming extinct, says Angus. And Annabelle says, thanks to Larry and this act, the black-footed ferrets were saved. And then on the next page, the judges in the highest court in the state agreed, and we are finally safe. And there you see all of the animals rejoicing. And the lawyer said that one of the greatest joys of his life was helping the Haverfields, the prairie dogs, the endangered ferrets, and the other prairie wildlife. And then the prairie dogs are saying, everyone work together, and teamwork pays off. And then Larry said many times that helping us was the right thing to do. He hoped more people would learn to appreciate and understand the importance of protecting local wildlife. And there you see Larry, one of the last pages saying helping wild, or actually the prairie dogs are saying about Larry, helping wildlife is the right thing to do, and it makes you feel good. And then finally, Larry and his friends helped others see that they could grow plenty of food and support their families by selling what they raised, even with us on the land. We and the other wildlife on Larry's land are thriving today because of everything he did. Other brave people are carrying on his work, too. So back to your previous question, we are making some converts, but it's slow and hopefully steady. And then finally to the last page, and I knew we had a winner here when Kathy Lucas, one of Larry's daughters, wrote me, and when she looked at the manuscript and saw this illustration, she said, I knew that, you know, this was the right thing to do, because it brought tears to my eyes, because there's my dad on his motorcycle with his orange hoodie riding off into the sunset. And the last page says, and when people ask them why he did it, just like Larry, we hope they will answer, or excuse me, when people ask them why they want to help wildlife, just like Larry, we hope they'll answer, because it is the right thing to do. Even the littlest creatures matter. Yes, we do. So, Jerry, I know you'll be interested in the next two pages if you have some crayons here, because those are kids' chance to color Annabelle and Angus and Larry himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Getting it. Of course, I have difficulty staying in the lines, so I'm just, you know, I'm not sure if I really want
That's
to,
okay.
you know, attack that, but... what a phenomenal, not only a story about Larry, his personal story, and but how you're able, this is a beautiful work of creation here.
Well, thank you.
Take this story, a very powerful one, environmental one, et cetera, and your first thought was, okay, I can write this big tome, you know, master's level, whatever, but who would it convert? Who would you? But to get to, because the children are, you know, we see that with the millennials and younger ones, think it very differently than old farts like you and me, and that, you know, oh, it's the way it's always done, you know, and said, well, no, that's just not the case anymore.
Right.
I think it's brilliant.
And I want to put a plug in here real quick. I have a second children's book along the same topic at a publisher now, and I'm, you know, hoping against all hope that it is going to see the light of day. And this one came to mind back to our earlier conversation about the social aspects of wildlife conservation and the political aspects, and which is really what it's all about. We have all of the biology we really need. This is now a social/political/economic issue. And so grabbing a hold of that, I think that there are some really untapped avenues for wildlife conservation. And one of them, I think, is a faith-based approach, whatever that faith may be. And another one is the economic approach. And so I've come up with something called the Francis Initiative, named after old St. Francis, who's the patron saint of ecology and wildlife. And it's a concept that envisions a future in which wildlife habitat conservation is a priority, not an afterthought. And it seeks a world in which abundant wildlife habitat, healthy economies, and healthy cultures are mutual and complementary. In other words, it's not an either-or thing. It's we're all in this together, and let's make everything work. Certainly, we all want to be safe, and we want to be prosperous, but do we do that at the expense of wildlife or along with wildlife conservation? So you may recall, it's been a little over a year now where what is in many people, this new Pope, Pope Francis, named obviously after that saint, has become much of a radical in some of the more conservatives' eyes and in his outlook on the future. And one of those things he's talked about through an encyclical is this very idea of wildlife conservation. And so as I was finishing up this book, that came out, and I said, wow, if we could grab a hold of that and get it out there, not so much in a strictly religious fashion, but just the idea of such a well-known world leader talking about the importance of this. Yeah. And so this is called Francis Frames the Future, and it brings out just very small parts of that 100-and-some page encyclical about wildlife and the need to save it. So okay. Hopefully that'll see the light of day.
Okay. So just to clarify, so is it also going to be a book similar to this?
Yes.
And bring the Holy Father's point to the level of comprehension for, you know, 4 to 8, 10-year-olds.
Exactly. And the idea, again, being that hopefully parents will be influenced as well. And it actually starts out, the book starts out where this leaves off. It starts out with Annabelle and Angus handing the baton, so to speak, off to two mourning doves out of Kansas. And they begin to fly over the rest of the continents of the world looking down and saying, you know, the Pope said this, and we can see that happening, and this is what needs to happen. And the whole time, it isn't, again, just about wildlife. It's intertwining the lives of people with the creatures that we share the planet with. So, you know, again, it might be confined to a more narrow audience, but I think I have it in the right hands, and I'm hoping that somehow, some way, it's going to get published.
Matt, I'm very confident this is going to, you know, it's already successful. You got it out of Audubon Society, and to get, you know, get this nationwide, whatever. And it's my own personal philosophy, you know, and perspective. But yesterday, an old friend of mine, a good friend of mine, and Marilyn Buehler, so Marilyn, if you're listening, you know, thank you. And she lives in Phoenix, and so she's up here in town. And so we had lunch yesterday, and got talking a bit, and she said, oh, tell me, what's going on with your radio show? I want to listen to it tomorrow. And I said, well, I have two guests coming in, and I told her about Richard and everything. Well, then I mentioned you. And I stumbled over, I said, Haversford, I think, over Larry's last name. And she said, no, it's Haversfield. And I said, how do you know that? And she said, I grew up with him. What a story. And she knows Larry's sister, Ruth Ann, who lives in Phoenix, so hopefully a student. And I said, well, you can listen to us, so if they are, that's wonderful. But that synchronicity, I mean, why this person, why at this time, and get this out? And I think what ends up happening is that there's a message here. There's a powerful story. You love storytelling. I love storytelling. And, you know, to bring us to consciousness in what is the best medium to do this in, and through the eyes of children. I think it's brilliant.
Right. And I brought these two books for Ruth Ann and Marilyn. Ruth Ann is Larry's sister, correct?
Yes.
And so hopefully they will get that and, you know, continue to spread the word. But yeah, that synchronicity, as you call it, cosmic vibrations or whatever else, I think is on our side as we go into the future. And you know, I really want to make this my life's work, as I mentioned on the way up. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find the right way to do that as far as an occupation, right. But that's fine. I've never really done anything for money, and I've, you know, survived and survived quite well. So I'm not driven that much by money. I'm driven by passion. And so I will continue to speak out and do whatever I can. You know, back to kind of the religious connection, more and more faith organizations, religions, denominations, what have you, are starting to understand that, you know, this is really a part of what their faith should be about. And this transcends Christianity and Hinduism and Buddhism and everything. I have some great books on all of those religions talk about this. So tomorrow up in Keensburg at the Wildlife Sanctuary, there are going to be some faith organizations up there talking about some organizations that are already in place. The Evangelical Environmental, or the Environmental Evangelical Network is one, and others. And this kind of transcends conservative, liberal, progressive politics, and I, you know, everything's political, of course, but I want to transcend that, because conservatives and Republicans and Democrats and liberals and everyone in between love wildlife, or should be introduced to wildlife conservation. And I like to keep the politics out of it, even though things like the Endangered Species Act and the attempts to gut it right now in Congress and so on are always going to be there. So if the people can get a hold of this in their economics and in their social lives and in their faith lives and, you know, every other aspect, and that's my goal before I die, to at least start that movement.
Very nice. I love it. Talk about your website.
Well, the website is mattpergles.com, and there's a couple of links on there. I haven't been there for a few weeks now, but there's some links on there of me standing out in a prairie, not to be a prairie for long, because it's right near DIA and it will be developed. Also standing on an off ramp on I-70 with thousands of cars buzzing around me. And these prairie dogs, in spite of everything that human beings have done to them over the years, and not just them, but so many other animal species, but especially them, since they have been vilified so much, in spite of all of that, you know, they're still thriving to the extent that we've allowed them to. And so in a little probably acre site where the off-ramp is and I-70 is there, millions of people coming by there in a year, noise, pollution, litter, you know, there's a prairie dog colony thriving. And so I stand there and talk about the book, and then I go to a quieter place and talk about Larry and kind of give some background as to what we were trying to do with the book and what I hope to do, kind of what I just mentioned to you. So it's mattpergles.com is the website. And hopefully we'll have some news to post up there in a few weeks that Francis Frames the Future is online and ready to go.
Right on. Oh, my God. This is an amazing story. It's synchronicity how it came together, because you just contacted me out of the blue. And hey,
right. And I,
wow.
Someone on my, you know, I was looking at my Facebook site, which I don't do that often, maybe once every 2 days. And I saw something about your show and I was reading through it, and you were saying that you're going to have authors on. And so I remember our conversations a few years back about politics, and I just sent you a message saying, how's it going? Do you remember me? I've got this book out. If you need to kill some time, I'd love to come and talk about it. So I appreciate being here very much.
Well, I don't kill time. I like to have these conversations and you know, get the messages out, too. So
good.
It's great, yeah. So a little rough start there coming up, but we got it rolling. And
worked out well.
It worked out well.
Good. Thanks for your flexibility.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, the 4 o'clock hosts are not here, so we were able to splash.
All right, I'm not alone.
Right on, yeah. Oh, it's crazy. But, you know, that's the beauty of community radio. We're not just like hogtied into this, oh, it has to be right, like this.
That's exactly right.
It's natural. It's organic. It flows. And, you know, and people out there in listener land love it, you know.
Yeah, they'll that's exactly what I was thinking. We don't have to satisfy the big sponsors. And,
right on.
You know, there's not 20 people standing around here looking at their watches. So that's
exactly
a beautiful thing.
Well, all right. So, hey, everyone, this is Jerry Fabiano, KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And I've been visiting here with Matt Burgles, and that's BERGLES. So Matt Burgles, go to mattburgles.com, learn more about Larry Saves the Prairie. And maybe you might want to invite Matt to come and talk to your children's group at school or something like that. I think it'll be awesome. You know, and to, not only it's a great story, a powerful, I'm reading this thing here, but it was a message too, and kids can handle this big time. you know, they can get it in their consciousness. And, you know, so.
And it's a beautiful book, I think. I'm biased, of course, but I love the illustration. I think the cover's great. There's lots of great colors in here, lots of great textures. So it's just a beautiful book. And again, my hat is off to Rob Peters and all his talent. He really makes the book above and beyond anything that I did.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. It is. It's just, you know, and it's attractive. It's appealing. As soon as you look at it, you want to grab it. And the colors themselves, the green, the gold, you know, and it just turns in the beautiful sunrise. And then he goes into the sunset. And,
right.
Oh, it's just a grabber right there. You're like, oh, I want to read more. And you learn.
And it's available on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. And yeah, and if I come and do a book reading, I'll be happy to bring some and sign them, and maybe we can get a discount for them if we get a bunch of kids and their families who want them. So, and they were a tattered cover, too. I'm not sure if they're still carrying them, but they were in all the tattered cover stores in Denver.
Well, just go in and ask for it.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's right.
All right. Sounds great. All right. So, everyone, I will be back in a couple weeks, maybe. I'm not sure. Yeah, because I got some other things happening on the 30th. But it's just been delightful, great conversations today. And so, everyone, have a great you know, rest of the day and keep enjoying. Be safe. And I think what we're going to do is just do a little background music here until